I've been asked by a lot of you, what do you do in your church for women, as I've been in Australia. I have one women's ministry packet, and that's what I've just laid out over there. And there's all sorts of ideas for you there, for young mothers and for the working woman and all the sort of things that we do, for evangelism, for nurturing, that sort of thing. And that's what that material is. Please don't take it. It's the only one I've got to show people. But the name of our women's ministry pastor, who is on the staff, Laurie Katz, is on a little card in the front of that packet. And if you write to her, it's just $5 for the whole packet. All it is examples of what we've been doing. And she would be happy to send you that. I know some of you have been asking, and I'm here to ask questions about that, although, of course, that's not what I'm going to address now. The other resource I want to talk about is a newsletter for ministry wives that I edit. That means that I'm just the conduit. 16,000 ministry wives take this newsletter across America and outside America on the mission field, and I was very surprised to meet it here when I got to Perth. Perth Bible College has been disseminating that, apparently. This will be over there for you to look at, too. I usually tell congregations about it, not ministry wives, and suggest they buy it as a present for their pastor's wife. But there is very, very little out there and support networking for the pastor's wife. And my job is simply to get you writing for this. And then I take all the material that comes in and try and get the best of it shuffled out and put out so that we can support each other. Now then, I too, like Stuart, love these sort of times. Basically because I don't have to be a blessing. Do you know what I mean? Do you in your ministry feel every day you have to be a blessing? You just have to be a blessing because that's what ministry is all about. And when we get together with each other, it's sort of such a relief. And I always feel very inadequate, realizing that there are many of you out there that are a lot more experienced pastor's wife or ministry wife than I am. And yet I know the need we have for each other. Often ministry wives say to me, and incidentally, because of this work I'm doing with ministry wives and pastors' wives, I have been collecting surveys that are being done on clergy and their wives, and we are finding that there is an incredible attrition of ministry couples out of the ministry. We have been told since we came to Australia, thousands of pastors are now back in their secular employment. So this isn't just our problem. It seems to be all over the place. Out of 500 ministry wives surveyed by the National Association of Evangelicals, we find out that hundreds and hundreds of couples are leaving. The main reason is stress on the spouse. And I'm going to be addressing the ministry couple from that perspective today. If you've got an unhappy pastor's wife, you've got an unhappy pastor, in other words. If you've got an unhappy missionary wife, somebody's just told me who's a missionary background, you'll find that couple will come off the field. Whereas if you've got a happy ministry wife, even if the man is under a great deal of stress, they'll stay. And so this is a huge concern. From the Southern Baptist Convention alone, 116 ministry couples are leaving every month in America. And again, on a scale of 1 to 10, the reason is stress on the spouse. And until now, there hasn't been an awful lot done about this situation. The three reasons that we get are intrusion, impoverishment, and idealization, they tell us. Intrusion, competing for your husband's time, from the wife's perspective. Someone's always intruding, they tell me, in our life, in our family, in my plans. I live in a fishbowl, someone else wrote. A fishbowl with a lid on top, and I can't get out, even though I want to. Intrusion, impoverishment, I have no friends on my own level. 30% of those surveyed And incidentally, the Southern Baptist survey covered 3,000 ministry wives. 30% of those ministry wives said, I haven't any support on my own level. I daren't share my pressures with somebody in the congregation. My husband's never there. I'm impoverished in my own marriage relationship. Out of the 500 ministry wives that were surveyed by NAE, 3% admitted to extramarital relationships at that time of the survey, which is a very low figure because all the rest have left the ministry. So it's not only 3%, it's 3% that are still in the ministry that said, at this moment I'm engaging in an extramarital relationship, and if I could get out of this marriage I would, but for the sake of the church and the kids I'm staying, which is a convoluted way of looking at things. Impoverishment. No help. 1% of the ministry wives surveyed who were in big trouble, not just in that area, only 1% asked for help or went to help or had anywhere to go for help. The third reason, idealization. I want to be the super pastor's wife. I want to do it all. And this comes out of a sincere desire by the spouse to be the partner to her husband that she really wants to be. And it's my experience that most ministry wives really want to do it, and they want to do it well, and they want to do it better than anybody's done before. Their goals are very high and their ideals are there, but perhaps they're following a very efficient pastor's wife that did it better than they did in their estimation before. For all sorts of reasons, Dr. Jim Dobson, who did his own survey of 5,000 ministry wives, found that the biggest problem was a lack of self-esteem. They didn't feel valued. They didn't feel appreciated. Because they were looking to the congregation and trying to figure out what the congregation thought about them, and that colored what they thought about themselves. For many in the congregation didn't feel they had a very good pastor's wife, or she wasn't as good as the last, or she could be better, or she didn't meet the expectations. And of course that word expectations comes over every time you talk to a ministry wife. Pressures. The pressures of expectation. It's hard to be human in front of others when you're in a position of leadership. How do you bear private grief publicly? Do you draw the curtains around the parsonage and say it's none of your business? What do you do? One ministry wife told me not long ago, I feel the more I can do, the more worth I have. But I can't do it anymore. So what happens then to the feeling? What sort of a pastor's wife am I? 40% of all those surveyed in all the surveys answered the questions about depression. Said, yes, I'm depressed. 40%. This stems from anger, we're told by those that know. The Nazarene Church in America has been in the forefront of setting up a helpline from their seminaries for any pastoral couple in trouble. They are jammed with calls. And this might be a way to go. Maybe some of you here are in a position from a seminary or Bible college or from your own denomination or your own church in your own area to set up a help system. I am forever counseling ministry wives, and I say to them, who is there in your area? A wise pastor, not your own church situation. Another pastor from another denomination, just somebody that you would feel comfortable going to. And they can't find anyone, or they don't know anyone, for some reason or another. So there is a huge need. And what I want to do today is to try and find from the scriptures a couple that we can look at for a few good examples of what some of these pressures in ministry are all about and how they can be addressed. Now, when you look in the Bible, of course, it's very hard to find a ministry couple. I looked long and hard. Eventually, I came up with Peter and his wife. You say, who? Well, we know about Peter, but where's his wife? Who is she? Stuart always says that I'm very good at peeking around the corner of the verse. Well, around the corner of some verses, I find his wife, and I find what I need. He also says to me, Jill, when you're peeking around the corner of the verse, be careful you don't go all the way up the block. So I'll try to avoid doing that today. Peter and his wife, a ministry couple, a couple in ministry, talk about pressures that they had on their lives. Here was this little simple Galilean homespun girl. She didn't marry a preacher. She married a fisherman. We're told now that coming into our seminaries and Bible colleges, well over 50% are second career ministry couples. And so here's the wife dealing with a whole lot of pressures. I had a lovely home. I could get my kids' teeth fixed. Now I'm in this situation with half the salary. We can't make ends meet. We've all these children to clothe and feed and school. And if only we'd stayed in business, we would have been able to do it. What are we going to do now? Incidentally, stress on the spouse, but what about, number one, money? Or lack of it. Talk to somebody dealing with a ministry couple up in Michigan that are just about to leave their church. The board met just a month ago and said, you're going to have to sell your car and get a bicycle. Well, they have four kids to get to various places, and you can't do that in a bicycle. Stress because of the money or the lack of it. Very, very difficult. Peter and his wife were fishermen. At least they had a job. Maybe they weren't very well off, but at least they had a job until Peter left it to follow Jesus. And suddenly all sorts of pressures came. Now, Peter and his wife were both believers. How do we know? Well, we know Peter was a believer. How do we know she was a believer? Paul tells us. If you peek around the corner of the verse in the New Testament, Paul is defending his ministry at one point, and he says, listen, here, I have the right to lead about a believing wife. That's the King James. I love the picture. Lead about a believing wife. It's as if he's got a rope around her neck and he's leading her about. But you know what I mean. They were together in ministry at that point. I have as much a right as you, he says, to lead about a believing wife like Peter is doing. So at this point of Paul's writing, Peter and his wife were together in the Jerusalem-based ministry doing their thing. And Paul is saying, I have that right as well, but I waive it for the sake of the gospel where I'm concerned. Both of them were believers. And in a group as large as this, I always feel a group as large or small, whatever, it's always worth just mentioning the fact that both have to have that sense of calling if it's going to work. I often have a ministry wife say to me, no, my husband has the calling. I'm the cheerleader. I'm just here to support him. If you don't have a personal sense of your own discipleship and your own sense of calling, then it's not going to work as God intends it to work. When I say calling, I mean, what would you be doing, if I can ask the spouses this, if you weren't in the ministry, if you weren't married, if you were single, wouldn't you be doing something for Jesus? You are simply a disciple disguised as a ministry wife, aren't you? And it's that sense of calling I'm talking about. Peter addresses this in his epistle, heirs together of the gracious gift of eternal life, personal heirs of Jesus. And if we lose that just because we marry the pastor, we're going to be in trouble, and so is the ministry that God has entrusted to us as a couple. And I find so often that the woman says, no, it's his ministry, I'm just here to cheerlead. And then you won't feel part of things. Together with your individual gifts, and each will be different, you are together heirs of the gracious gift of eternal life, and the stewards of those mysteries of grace together, the under rowers, each with an oar, one for the wife and one for the husband, pulling together, both believers. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Stewards of my marriage verse. He wouldn't be doing it, and I wouldn't be standing saying, yay, yay, go, go. We together would be doing it. When the children, as for me and my house, came along, we together. Children wouldn't be watching mom do it or dad do it. We together would serve the Lord. I'm absolutely convinced our kids are in ministry today for that reason, of that sense that the ministry did not intrude into our family, The family was the environment where ministry happened as naturally as breathing. And it was theirs as much as it was ever ours. Stuart and I have just written a book called Pulling Together When You're Pulled Apart. And basically it's a book about ministry and marriage. It's our story, for what it's worth. And it's how we've coped or tried to cope or are still coping with the pressures of all the things I'm talking about. We rang our daughter from here 2 days ago. I didn't tell you this. The one thing I forgot to tell you, Stuart. No, he knows I rang our daughter. He dialed the number for me. But I didn't tell him this. She said, I've just finished reading yours and Dad's book. It came out the week we left. And she said, I cried all the way through it. I cried all the way through it. Mom, she said, it's wonderful. And she said, I want our marriage to be an example like that. And that was very special for me to hear. A ministry marriage, they were happy tears. A ministry that has happened because of that context and environment that we breathed. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Both believers, both receivers. When Peter received Jesus into his boat in Luke chapter 5, he got a shock. He met Jesus' friends in that chapter, all sorts of wild people. The leper, the blind man, the demon-possessed, all in one chapter, all in a day. And Peter, the true blue Jew, found that to receive Jesus means to receive Jesus' friends. And Jesus has some odd friends. Have you noticed? Really odd friends. The context of our ministry has to be that open home where people can come, Jesus' friends. And this has been rather hard for me because I'm an English lady and the Englishman's home is his castle in a way that doesn't pertain anywhere else in the world. You know, we have every right to be in our castle and shut the door and invite into our castle whoever we want to come in. But when I found Jesus, I decided or discovered that now I couldn't have hours like the post office. And that our home had to be that home where Jesus was known to be. It was noised abroad, it says, at the early part of the gospel that Jesus was in the house and the whole town gathered at the door and they tore off the roof of the house to get to him. Now then I have to ask myself, do people in my environment tear off the roof of our house to get to us? Not because they want to come and see what sort of a meal I cook or what sort of drapes I have on the windows. They come because they know that Jesus is there. That's the context of ministry that I see Peter and his wife beginning to have. Because in Mark's gospel, where Jesus comes into their home to heal the mother-in-law, in Mark chapter 1, we find that little phrase, the whole town gathered at the door. And I believe that the whole town will beat a path to the ministry couple and the ministry family because Jesus is in the house. Now that, of course, brings its own pressures, and we'll talk about some of those. So they were both believers. They were both receivers, partners in receiving God's blessing. In 1 Peter chapter 3, we get a lot of instructions from Peter on ministry marriages. He starts off the beginning of the chapter addressing the problem if a woman has an unbelieving husband, but then he seems to go into what it's like to be heirs together and the ministry couple. Now, if you do talks together, any of you, on marriage, like I know many of you do, I'm sure you draw from your own experience. If you read 1 Peter chapter 3 with that in mind and into chapter 4, you'll see a whole different slant because Peter's giving a talk on marriage, on being heirs together of the gracious gift of eternal life and how to treat each other and how to help each other deal with the pressures. And I'm sure he couldn't have done that if he wasn't drawing on his own experience. And I have a feeling that he and his little wife had a lot of things to sort out, coming from the background they come from. I mean, here's this poor little woman, suddenly married to the head of the Christian church, if you like. Or one of the leaders of the Christian church. And he'd just been an old fisherman. Probably why she married him. Good, solid job, you know, they'd be all right. Live humbly by the side of Galilee all their life. And suddenly it takes off. Jesus walks into her life, walks off with her husband for 3 years, never apologizes. And she has to cope with all of this. What a shock. And yet apparently she manages to adjust. Both believers, both receivers. I wonder if Peter's wife had the gift of hospitality. Let's stop here a minute. That day that the mother-in-law was healed and the whole town gathered at the door and Jesus used their home as an environment of ministry. When I get to heaven, I'm going to ask her. I've written a lot about women in the Bible during the years that I've been writing. I really don't want to die and go to heaven because I'm going to meet all these women I've written about. They're going to say, what about chapter 7 in such a book? I'm not afraid of meeting Peter's wife. I've only had good things to say about her. And I want to figure out if I've been right in my assumptions about her. I do want to know if she had the gift of hospitality. What did she do the day the whole town gathered at the door? Of course, we have to be careful we don't mix up the gift of hospitality and the gift of hostessing. The gift of hospitality, or the command to be hospitable, is addressed to the men, basically, as far as I can see, the leaders of the church. It's the love of strangers, isn't it, that word? And I suppose the men were supposed to go to the assembly where strangers were coming in, figure out who they were, make a beeline for them, persecute them, hunt them down, bring them home to the little woman who hopefully had the gift of hostessing. All of us have to have the love of strangers. Fortunately for this, we have Jesus, and he has the love of strangers. What happens if you don't have the gift of hostessing and you're in ministry as a wife? It's hard. Very hard. We can use the parsonage as a security blanket and disappear there if we like. Use it as an excuse. Now I'm the pastor's wife, I don't need to do these things. I need to keep a little enclave so that he can find some peace and quiet. Or we can make a friend with someone in the church who has that wonderful gift of hostessing. That's what I do. I make best friends with the woman that I know is very good at it. And when I'm asked to have the elders' wives, incidentally, that strikes fear into my heart. I used to work with street kids. Give me 100 street kids with leather jackets and chains on their backs, and I'm ready. But give me 12 deacons' wives. I have to entertain. I want to die. I just want to die. I'm frightened of that. I don't know how to do it. So I find someone that does know how to do it. And I say, would you come and help me and show me how to do this and help to make my home that environment and that context? So you have to be available. You have to be flexible. And if you're very organized, incidentally, it's hard to be flexible. If you've got your schedule, if you've got your agenda, and Jesus brings the whole town into your house, what happens to your agenda? Do you say, well, this wasn't on my agenda? We heard about a man that just invited, this is in America, the whole of his group he'd been with back to his house for coffee. He got in his car phone, which they all seem to have in America, and said to his wife, oh, I'm just bringing the committee back, and apparently got an earful and had to turn around, and they were literally going in the car and say, I think we'd better meet at McDonald's instead. She couldn't be flexible. It's like those big buildings you see in California that are built on rock because of the earthquakes, but with flexibility in every joint. Jesus has to help us to do that. Well, Peter's wife certainly had to learn to be a receiver and a reliever. In the Acts of the Apostles, we see them in community relieving the needs of others. But all this brings us to the point of how do you organize these priorities? I'm really talking about priorities because the pressures, I think, come on the ministry couple where the man has to figure out his priorities and the woman has to figure out her priorities, and every priority seems to be a priority. What do you do with it? Is it God first, church next, family last? Family first, church next, God last? God, family, you know. Every permutation, I think, I've wrestled with. 14 years in missions with Stuart on the road, 9 to 10 months a year. 20 years in the pastorate. Traveling ministry around the world. You talk about priorities. I've felt pulled in 5 different directions most of my life. More than that, that's just 5 where the family's concerned. And then you get the church and the ministry and everything else on top of that. And I've really come at this stage of my life, very old, a little bit of experience behind me, to realize that whatever the king says is first has to be first today. The Bible definitely says first the king and first the kingdom. That's the priority principle. We put God first. But what does that mean? I think it means, what does the king say is first today? And that will be something different every day. And that will be something different according to the season of life, the number of children, or no children, etc., etc. The gifts of the couple, the situation of the couple, whether you're working, whether you're not outside the home. How can one couple say to another, first this, first that, first the other? There's no way. Look at the Jesus model. What the king said was first for Jesus was 30 years in Nazareth. And when he did that, everybody said how balanced he was. He increased in wisdom, stature, favor with God, and favor with man. Absolutely balanced. And everybody thought it was terrific. That's what the God said was first. A balanced life for Jesus. Then 3 years on the road. In Mark chapter 3, as soon as he goes out of his front door, never to return again, never to lay his head on his home bed pillow again, the whole world goes crazy at him. And you know what they say all through that chapter? He's unbalanced. Because what the king said was first for Jesus was not what the people thought should be first for him. His family came. It says they didn't even have time to eat. That's unbalanced. You should be balanced in the ministry. They said he's out of his mind. They came to put him in constraints, the word is. He's flipped. He's gone overboard. You've got to have time to eat. And they came to take him home by force, it says. In fact, they said, we've come to take him home. We can't even see him because of the crowd. Will you tell him we're here? And when Jesus heard that they were there, he said, who is my mother and my brothers and my sisters? The forever family of God now takes precedence over my own family relationships. And they said, that's unbalanced. That's not right. Other people's children before your children? Other people's relationships before yours? How can that be right? Only if God dictates it. And apparently for Jesus, that's what God was dictating. And that wasn't unbalanced. How could it have been? That was balance. So 30 years in Nazareth, 3 years on the road, putting other people's families in front of his own, even on the cross with his hands pinned into place, when he must have longed to look after his own mother, he gave her into the care of someone else to look after. That's the pressure on the ministry wife. When do I look after my own children, and when does somebody else babysit them so I can attend to some duty or other? In the church, lead the Bible study, fulfill the expectations. It's a pressure. What does the king say is first today? It might be stay home, look after your kids. What does he first say? It might be let somebody else look after my kids so I can do such and such a thing. The whole art is figuring out what God dictates. And you know, if Jesus is first, and this comes back to that personal sense of calling, you'll know what's next. It's amazing. You really will. If Jesus is first, in principle, you'll know what's next. Then it's a question of having the courage to do it, whatever people say. I remember struggling a lot in many ways when Stuart was on the road as an evangelist, as you can imagine. And I remember not being very greatly helped by the Church of Jesus Christ at that point, who were very free to tell me and tell Stuart, except they didn't tell Stuart he was on the road. They told me what he should be doing. The kids will never make it, Jill. Never make it. How can Stuart fulfill the biblical role of a father and be away all this time? Now, that didn't help me. I was struggling with it already. What did help me, however, was the wise words of a Canadian missionary who happened to be staying with me when that particular church leader came to tell me this. as Stuart had just left the day before for a 3-month trip. And miserably I sat there and listened to him. And she very quietly said from her corner where she was knitting, "But how can Stuart fulfill the biblical role of an evangelist and be home all the time?" This was what the king had dictated, you see, for us. 3 years married, 10 years on the road, now in America, more or less together. Although the only book we've ever written together, which is the one I told you about, Pulling Together When You're Pulled Apart, was written apart. Par for the course. He was in South Africa, I was in Holland, you know, that's how it goes, par for the course. But more or less together at this point. What has the king dictated for us isn't what the king will dictate for you or for anyone else. But these are the pressures. Figuring that out are the pressures that we have to cope with. How do we do that? A personal Gethsemane, a personal Calvary, and a personal Pentecost. That's how you do it. And that's why the wife specifically has to nurture her relationship, her personal relationship with God, very tenderly, not allow her husband to become her Holy Spirit. It's going to take both of us to figure it out. It's going to take both of us to have that personal Gethsemane where we will probably say at some point in our ministry, "I don't want to do this. I don't want to be here." Like Jesus said in Gethsemane, "I don't want to do this. I don't want to be here. This is this part of the ministry I'm not looking forward to. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done." And pull ourselves alongside the will of God. Once we've done that through personal prayer, battling it through in our own relationship with God, we'll need a personal Calvary where I is crucified. And then, of course, we'll need a personal Pentecost. For who is sufficient for these things? If the job is going to get done, I reckon that the ministry families are going to have to bear the brunt and the cost of it. After all, someone left somebody's family to come and tell us in England the gospel someday. Who was it? I don't know. Maybe in heaven we'll find out. And in those days, they'd leave their family to do it and perhaps never see them again. Like the early missionaries who used to pack all their goods in their coffin, not a suitcase, when they went to Africa, specifically the Methodist mission. Just finished reading a biography of the early Methodist missionaries that went to that specific part of Africa that's called the white man's grave. And I can't remember, I think it was 13 or 14 of the first pioneer missionaries died within 2 or 3 months of landing of the diseases that they met. But they were ready for it. They'd brought their coffin. Where's it all gone? Now I believe that God has got shifted out of being God of the family and dictating our terms to us. And now the family has become God. And as Lewis says, put anything in his place and it will destroy the very thing you're trying to keep. So we have to get this balance. And I believe it starts with our personal battle over this. But then what happens with the husband and the wife together as they begin to work it out? Well, how did Peter cope? In 1 Peter 3 verse 7, he says, "As far as the man's concerned, you have to live with a wife according to knowledge. Try to understand the wives you live with. Figure her out in the modern terms." We are different, and the men need to know us and understand us in two ways in these verses. Respect our weak points and honor our strengths. We had a wonderful time with this. I think it was in Perth or Adelaide, I can't remember now, with a pastor's conference. I simply threw out a question off the top of my head. I said, "What does it mean that the wife is the weaker vessel? Have you ever talked as a couple about that?" Well, we talked for about half an hour about it in the big group. It was marvelous. What does it mean? Have you ever figured it out that we're the weaker vessel? Does it mean physically? Well, maybe we can't bench press, but we're going to outlive you, so they tell us. So it can't mean that. We're stronger in the long run. Does it mean emotionally? No. I live with women, deal with women, minister to women most days of my life. And I think they're wonderful. 800 single parents in our church, so I'm told. And they are the bravest, most wonderful young women, most of them young, that I work among. You tell me they're weak emotionally? They're strong. Crisis comes, who's the strong one? Now, it can't mean that. Intellectually? Well, I don't mean that. I don't believe it. Do you? Then what does it mean? I do believe it means sexually. It's part of our femininity to be weak despite ourselves once a month. And then, of course, with all our hormones going crazy, here we are trying to have a ministry and bring up teenage children whose hormones are all going crazy at the same time. We're weak. I believe it because this word is only used in one other place, and that's where Paul uses it, where he says, keeping your vessel sexually pure. And the weaker vessel, I believe, is used in that context. So if you can try and figure us out, according to our femininity and sexuality, it would be a wonderful help. And also, if you could honor our strength, that would help too. Peter talks about challenging. Each one should use whatever gift they have to serve others. And that means my wife, I'm sure he added, as well as me. Now, his wife's gifts, I don't know what they were. I don't know what your gifts are. I know what my gifts are. And I also know and am thankful to God for a husband who knew what they were before I did and insisted that they were developed under his nurturing and protection and help and poking. And I would have to say that if Stuart had not changed his views theologically, coming from his background, I would probably have been a very angry, frustrated Christian woman today. And not one of my gifts would have been exercised, used. I wouldn't have written any books. I wouldn't have spoken to anybody, anywhere, ever. And I really don't know what I would have done without a Peter who helped me to use the gifts he discerned in me before I ever saw them myself. He honored my strength. And he insisted, and not only insisted, made it possible for me to develop to be the woman that God had gifted me to be. I remember him writing an article for Moody Monthly that caused correspondence for the best part of a year. They asked him to address women's gifts in ministry. And on the front of the Moody Monthly magazine, they put a burial urn and Stuart's lead article, a question. The Bible says that we should not bury our gifts, but what happens if we bury someone else's? One day, I as a man have to stand before God and answer for the gifts he entrusted to me and my wife and my daughter. And that's sort of heavy, especially if you bury them. Well, I'm fortunate to be in that situation where that didn't happen to me. He's just about figured me out where my weaknesses are concerned, although he's still working on that. And he's certainly honored the strengths he saw in me. That's what husbands need to do for wives. And wives who are weak in so many areas because of our sexuality need to find that balance of what we're supposed to be doing and what we're supposed to be carrying for him. The best illustration I know about this is to go back to a little incident in Jesus' life where he talks about, come unto me all ye that labor and are heavy laden and I will give you rest. And he uses a boat term there. Come unto me, you fishermen. Now remember who he was talking to, who have loaded your little fishing boats so full they're sinking without a trace. And I'll help you to load them right. Around each boat, there's a water line. It's called a plimsoll line. When I was a little girl, my dad took me down to Bootle, where the ships were coming in to sustain us during the war. And I remember seeing the water line and all the cargo sitting on the deck and asking my dad what the line was around the boat. And he said, that's to help to balance it right. And I looked at all this cargo and I thought, how can that cargo get on that little tiny boat? And he said, well, there's quite a lot under the water, but the whole art is to get the right amount of cargo on the right vessel. And you see, we're all different sorts of boats. Every wife here is a different boat. Every husband here is a different boat. I stand in church and watch the boats come in to worship on a Sunday. Great big battleship comes through the door. Followed by a little tiny dinghy, you know. Little tiny skiff. And then a submarine that does all its work out of sight, you know. Everybody's different. Everybody's built by the boat builder in a different way. And the whole art of not sinking under all these pressures, this cargo that we put on ourselves or other people or the church put on us, is figuring out what sort of a boat you are. Helping each other figure that out. And then not overloading. Now, if you don't bear anything, you're going to be unfulfilled. I've met a lot of ministry wives that are unfulfilled. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. And the whole art as a couple in ministry is to figure out what you should be carrying, to bear one another's burdens, to come alongside sometimes, say, I need to offload some of that onto my boat. To bear your own burden where God dictates it, and to steam out across the sea of life together. It's hard. I remember taking on a cargo of books. I always sink my own boat. All that's left of me is a little white flag most of the time. But I'm very hard on myself. I'm an extreme overachiever. And I love everything I do. That's one of my problems. And so I take on all this cargo. People write to me and say, God has told me you should write this book. Well, who am I to say God hasn't? And so I sign the contract. And somebody writes and says, we've prayed for a year about a speaker for a big convention, and God has directed us to you. It's really funny that four other people have said the same on the same date. Somebody's wrong somewhere, but what do? I try to go to four places at once. That's the way I work. And so, of course, I sink my boat. And in this specific regard, I had sunk my boat with contracts for books all in a year. And Stuart observed that I was sinking without a trace. Actually, I think he didn't have any clean shirts at the time. It alerted him to the fact something was drastically wrong. And he sat me on his knee and he said, Joe, what's the matter? What have you done? I said, I'm just sinking. I did this and I did that and I took six things on at once. And he said, well, write them down. So I wrote them down. And he became the inspector of my boat at that point. And he said, well, boy, this is a wonderful opportunity. You have to do that. And you're obviously going to have to finish that. You're halfway through it. This is good. But you'll never get to this. And he took a pencil and just unloaded the boat. And I just panicked. I mean, I'd signed the contract. I said, I'll go to prison, start a prison ministry. Will you visit me? You know, just total panic stations. And he said, leave it to me. And he wrote to the publishers. And he got that cargo off me. He unloaded my boat. He could see I was unbalanced. I'd loaded my own boat until I was sinking. And so how did Peter cope? He knew his wife. He'd figured her out. He loved her. He challenged her. And he helped her to balance. And how did she help Peter? I believe in the same way. We don't have as much information. But in 1 Peter 3, wives, in the same way, be submissive to your husbands. It's a big subject in itself. Respond to your husbands. Have a sweet spirit, a submissive spirit. Have a spiritual spirit. A strong spirit, it's all there. Do what's right and don't give way to fear, he says in this same context. I wonder if he was talking about his wife. I just honestly can't imagine that little Galilean homespun girl not being frightened, not being overwhelmed. I remember coming to America as a new pastor's wife. Everything in me wanting to do the job as that bionic Christian lady in Proverbs 31, you know. So I've always detested, to tell you the truth. Because I want to be and I can't and I'm not. Unfortunately, she never existed, but anyway, she's there as a model. And finding that I wasn't and I couldn't and I didn't Actually, it was the first time I'd ever belonged to a church the day I became a pastor's wife. So it was a shock for me and the congregation. Converted out of nothingness at Cambridge through intervarsity influence. I sort of went straight into youth work and met Stuart and ended up at mission, youth mission for 12 years, and then to America, called to the church. And the youth mission had its own meetings on a Sunday. And so here I was, the new pastor's wife, and a clue. Well, I looked around good old Milwaukee, which is 90% Catholic, and I couldn't find any models for obvious reasons. Priests don't marry. And so I thought, where's a pastor's wife I can look at and find out how to do it? Well, I couldn't find any of those. No time. So I just went up and down the pews and found the ladies and said, what do you expect of me as a pastor's wife? Would you write it on this piece of paper, please? That's how naive I was. And so they all obliged and said, oh, we'd be delighted. And they all wrote down their expectations. Well, I was very excited. I thought, this is terrific. All I do is read the list and start and try and fulfill them all. And so I took it home and started to read the list. And when Stuart came in, he found me making an English cup of tea, which is what you do in times of crisis, and crying into it and saying, I'm going to get leukemia and die and God's going to give you an American wife. I'm out of this. Stuart's been a terrible mistake. There is not one of my gifts on this piece of paper. Now, I know I have gifts, but not one of them was on that piece of paper. And all the things that were on that piece of paper, I can assure you, I was not gifted in. Therefore, what was I going to do? And he looked at me thoughtfully and said, if a job's worth doing, Jill, it's worth doing badly. Well, I knew that was wrong. If a job's worth doing, it's worth doing well, I replied. He said, I didn't say that. How do people learn to do things well? By starting to do them badly. But I said, this is visibly and badly, Stuart. I mean, what they want me to do is going to be visibly and badly done. And he said, well, are you willing to do that? I said, I don't know. He said, well, you know, job's worth doing, it's worth doing badly. And off he went whistling. He always goes off whistling. Very interesting. Leaves me there in a heap at the table, trying to figure it out. I did find a wonderful verse that day as I looked in the scriptures for confirmation of this extraordinary thought, because generally speaking, if I can't do it well, I'm not going to do it. And that's why nothing gets done. Could I do it visibly and badly? And I found that wonderful verse that said, whatever your hand finds to do, do it heartily as unto the Lord. And I thought, well, at least I can do that. I can do it heartily and badly. For Jesus. Because it has to be done. And so that's what I did. 20 years ago, I began to very heartily and badly try and be the pastor's wife I was not gifted to be. As I did this extraordinary thing, visibly, a lot of people sitting in the pews looked at me, and some of them who had been sitting on their backsides and never done anything for years, who had the gifts I didn't have, said, what is she doing? That's awful. And they came to me and said, can we help you? And I said, oh yes, please. And that's the way you get all the jobs done in the church. Wonderful. I figured it out. Do it heartily and badly and someone will come and help. Somebody that can do it. And the other thing I discovered was some of those things I was willing to do because they had to be done, I found I could do goodly and I didn't know. And that's the way you discover your gift. You don't know you have. Of course. Isn't that wonderful? Now, my Peter helped me to do that. And actually, it got us into a lot of trouble in our church because I discovered that women responded to me in the American culture, basically because I have an English accent. I had no idea that would be so useful, but I used it to the full. And I began to get into their homes, teach them. They came to Christ, 30 women, extraordinary women, gifted women, found the Lord in this home. And I said to them one day, shortly after we arrived in America, where do you sit in church? Because I never see you. And they said, we don't go to your church. But we didn't like to tell you because our pastor doesn't believe any of the things you're teaching us. I thought, what have I done? Here I am teaching this other man from this other church's women things he doesn't want me to teach. What do my women think? They don't even come to my church. Well, I run home and tell Stuart all this. And he said, well, you didn't know. This is wonderful. They've all found the Lord in the last month. You can't stop. Get on with it. You know, just don't bring it to church. Just keep it in the homes. Well, it grew out of the home. Where could we go? We went into a bank building. We grew out of that. Where could we go? We took a theater. 800 women ended up in this theater. It was wild. It was wonderful. But what was the church, our church, doing? They were saying, what is she doing? We wanted to be in church leading this little women's thing. And Stuart said, you've got wonderful women leading this little women's thing. Let her be who she is. Who have you got reaching the women of Milwaukee? Well, they didn't quite see it like that. And I remember one of those wonderful occasions when we were invited round to the elders and wives for a meal. And I very naively thought, oh, how nice, this is wonderful. And we got there and we had a wonderful first course, second course, third course, and I was really relaxed and chattering away, you know. And suddenly the leader of the elders board said, Stuart, we've really asked you here tonight to discuss what Jill is doing. And I just went cold inside. And they said, you know, it was only in love, it was only in appreciation. We want her for our women. We want her to come and do this. And Stuart said, but we have people doing that. And don't you think it's wonderful what's happening? Why don't your wives come and help her do what's happening? And they said, no, this is what Jill must do. And I just sat there wanting to get under the table. And Stuart very quietly said, listen, you hired me, not my wife. And what is more, if you insist on telling my wife what to do, I will insist on telling your wives what to do. And that was the end of it. Well, it was sort of the beginning of it for me, but it was the end of it in that context. What you see on that table, this incredible burgeoning ministry of women to women, that is really, it's on video now, How to Grow a Women's Ministry. Goes all over the place. Beginning, freshening what you've got, expanding. We have our own women's television program now. All by 40 women that learned how to do it, that couldn't point a camera and get your head in it when they began. God has just taken that thing and taken it on its way. Why? Because my husband honored my strength. And because he helped me to be the woman that God had made me to be. And now, as we minister together, it's not a competitive thing. And so often I hear men say to me, when I talk to men at pastors' conferences and Stuart talks to the women, sometimes we split and go that way. Men very honestly say to me sometimes, I am threatened by my wife's gifts. She's better at me in this regard. I can't handle that. It's a man of quality that can handle a woman of equality and gift. And he won't be threatened by his wife's spiritual giftedness. He'll be able to handle that. So it won't be a competitive thing, but a complementary thing. And in our experience at this point, we're finding that as together, very happily, in this season of our life, God is allowing us to do more and more together, even though we still have our individual ministries. A psychiatrist who heard Stuart and I speak not too long ago said to us, that was wonderful. It was a wonderful example of left brain, right brain. I'm glad he didn't say no brain, half brain. It's a question not of competing. It's a question of complementing. That's harder when your gifts are similar. Usually gifts complement easily. When you have similar gifts, it's harder to put that together in ministry. But God can help us to do that. Because we're on the same team. We're pulling in the same direction, hopefully. We're trying to be a Peter and his wife, getting the job done.